and on to our final speaker now, Frank Kelleher.
My brief for the presentation was to give you a feel for what is New Zealand's unique situation. There is a tremendous international interest in carbon. It's been alluded to by our speakers. Why is New Zealand different? And consequently, research is being conducted, as has just been described by the first three speakers. Firstly, New Zealand has some uncommon features that have been alluded to. Probably the most uncommon is the most widespread vegetation in this country is grass. David indicated 14 million hectares. The life of a grass leaf, as you may or may not know, is only about a month. And so this form of vegetation is herbaceous. Moreover, this land is managed purposefully and intensively for agriculture, the source of half of New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions, because we have 85 million farmed animals, ruminants, sheep and cattle managed, and only 4.5 million people. That's a very unusual combination that accounts for half of New Zealand's greenhouse gases being enteric methane from sheep and cattle, and also from nitrous oxide. As has been indicated, under grass, carbon storage in soil is already substantial. Moreover, there's a mixture in New Zealand soils, because the primal forest vegetation only cleared about 150 years ago. For agricultural soils, thinking of that map that those maps Louis showed, carbon storage data, that's actual sampled soils and measurements, it's quite fragmented. Geographic coverage across the land area of interest to us is limited, and most of the samples have been obtained near the surface, and I think that the illustration Brent just presented is brilliant for showing the vertical distribution of carbon in soils is quite important. And while in general much of the carbon will be located near the surface, not all of it. And in the management that Brent showed, there was an effect that was deep in the soil, not so much at the surface. There's been some research, as Brent was just alluding to, and Lewis, there's been some research, but little, about manipulating and verifying carbon storage rate in soil. I don't mean by that the quantity of carbon in soil. You recall that Lewis made the distinction between the rate of change. Carbon storage rate in soils has been measured beneath grazed pasture, as Lewis indicated, but there has been little research about manipulating and verifying the rate of change of carbon in soils. Likewise, agriculture is a dynamic endeavor. We've heard Brent indicate how orchard management has changed. Grazed pasture management has changed enormously in New Zealand, and in particular, the intensity of the conversion, so-called conversion dairy farms in the South Island, where one-third of the milk now comes from, whereby sheep and beef farms have been converted to dairy. So the management that can affect the rate of carbon storage is ever-changing, and we need to keep up with that and how that manipulation changes soil carbon. Now, it's a little bit like economics, that the rate of soil carbon storage is inevitably going to be relatively small relative to the quantity of carbon stored in the soil. The rate of change is going to be variable. It is. That's the nature of soils. Because the rate of change is small and variable, it's difficult to determine. It's not that researchers can't measure the total quantity of carbon in soils. That can be done, and done accurately. But sampling soils, as has been suggested, is challenging in order to capture the variability. Moreover, research that we're beginning now is looking at partitioning the total carbon into measurable functional fractions and connecting these to models in order to understand the change. As Lewis indicated in his presentation, careful measurements have indicated small changes. Brent showed small changes as well. Understanding those and what are the drivers of change is quite challenging. But nevertheless, seemingly small positive change, and it can be negative, but seemingly small positive change can be potentially very valuable. And that's because the sustainability of agriculture depends on natural capital, including carbon in soil, more so the addition of nutrients, the structure, the organic matter. That natural capital is what profitable agriculture depends on. I'd like to close this presentation with the greenhouse gas center that David introduced and refresh in your mind those questions that we have asked in the center. Are there upper limits for the quantity of carbon that can be stored in New Zealand soil? How big is the bucket? How much carbon is in the bucket? How much is currently stored? And how stable is it? How much is currently stored? As Lewis indicated, determining that across the country is quite challenging. We call that an inventory. There are inventories, but there are, as I indicated, ever-changing forms of agriculture that merit consideration, and it's challenging to determine how much is stored. We're very interested in the functional partitioning of that total carbon into pools. They might be based on the size of the carbon, the size of the fraction, very small fraction, very small portions. Can be quite stable. You might think of charcoal, for example. Soil carbon that's stored within an aggregate, within the structure of soil, is remarkably more stable than carbon in the free soil. Soil that has a different texture, like sand with larger bits, can hold less carbon than in soil with clay. We'd like to know about manipulating soils purposefully to retain or make that carbon stable, but also to increase the quantity of carbon stored. We want to manipulate the rate of soil carbon storage, and we need to better understand the drivers of change in order that we can understand that. And to make this operational, we envision acceptable accounting system with rules and protocols for verifying the rates of carbon storage change that can be responsive to soil management. There are a number of researchers, organizations involved in this. This problem of managing soil for organic matter for function is not a new problem, but there's an enormous heightened interest in this, and Brent alluded to the carbon footprinting. There's also the potential of both gain and liability for the quantity of carbon in soil, because ultimately this carbon has come from plants, it's come from the atmosphere, and it is all part of the greenhouse gas issue of reducing the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank. I will open the floor up to questions. Please bear with me for a moment while I unmute all the participants so that you will be able to speak and hear each other. I can start with a question from Kent, which he has entered in the chat box. Kent, go ahead.
Yes, I was interested in the issues raised by the concept of biochar. Can the rate of change be hugely accelerated by using biochar? Could you turn organic waste, such as, say, forest trimmings, into biochar and add it to depleting farm soils, such as dairy land, to reverse their loss of carbon? And what potential benefits could that bring to matters such as the macroporosity and the population of soil microorganisms in those soils?
One of our speakers like to have a go on that one?
Well, maybe I'll this is Frank Kelleher. I'd be happy to make a start. The addition of organic matter to soils is certainly a good thing, and Brent Clothier highlighted in the different management systems for the kiwi fruit orchard that the addition of compost had a beneficial effect on the quantity of soil carbon stored. The adjective huge is quite an emotive one. As I indicated in the presentation, I think Brent's data bears that out. Changes in the rate of carbon storage tend to be small and variable. Nevertheless, the point's well taken that biochar has attributes that it's intended to be a material that's relatively stable and possibly, although being investigated, there are added values. It's certainly a carbon-rich additive. It's intended to be stable, and consequently, I would agree with the questioner that, yes, it can make a valuable contribution potentially. I would say that, as we suggested towards the end of my presentation, that the benefits that are indicated need to be verified, and I think that there is some fundamental work needed in terms of quantifying the impact of the applications of biochar. Dose response experiments need to be conducted, and as was perhaps not entirely clear, but not all soils respond the same to organic matter. There are different attributes to soils that contribute to how stable carbon within them is, and so the response of soils to a biochar application may not be constant or uniform, but you know, the point taken by the speaker that biochar additions to soils can have a potential benefit.
Maybe I could just add there, Frank, that you will have seen on the Greenhouse Gas Research Center there was an entry there for Massey University. Massey University have two MAF-sponsored professors of biochar, one of a professor of pyrolysis, the creation of different biochars from different sources, and the professor of biochar and soil carbon, which is addressing the questions, the kind of questions that Frank was talking about. So just to follow it up, have any of you had any feedback from trials which I understand are underway at Lincoln in relation to the efficacy of biochar in pastures?
There has been a paper, I believe, accepted for publication whereby nitrous oxide, a greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide emissions from soils were measured. Some selected replicates had been amended with biochar, and my recollection is that there was a nil result for that. There was not an effect of a positive effect on the soil nitrous oxide emissions. That study did not look at the consequences for soil carbon storage.
I think it's fair to say, David, here, that it's quite early days yet for very few experiments have been done, certainly not in the field scale. They've tended to be pot experiments in New Zealand. But as Brent said, building on the effort of the centre and Lincoln and Massey Universities, we are funding new work which is going to specifically look at the impact of biochar. That work will start this spring.
Great. Do we have other questions from the floor?
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. Andrew Swallow here from the Rural News. Brent, you gave that example where compost had been added and resulted in an increase in organic matter in the soil. Is it known how much compost was added? Because presumably quite a bit of that carbon could also have been lost back to the atmosphere. And secondly, and this is to the general panel, please could the panel comment on the effect of inorganic fertilizers, particularly urea, on soil carbon content?
I'll have a go at the first one. I don't have that figure at my fingertips, but we do know the average rate at which compost was added to the organic orchard. I can find that, and I think you have my contact details, and I can send you a paper where we describe that in detail.
It makes it look like the organic soil is great, but I'm just concerned there's actually been a huge amount of carbon added, and maybe only 5 or 10% of it has actually ended up in the soil.
That is highly likely.
Yeah.
Can I just comment on that? There's been work done overseas also where manures have been added for long periods of time to soil, And yes, it increases carbon content, and I think you're right, only a proportion, a smaller proportion of that compost actually ends up in soil organic matter. The thing to remember, though, is if you stop putting on the compost or the manure, the carbon content will go back down again, and this has been shown in long-term experiments overseas. So if you can certainly increase the carbon content if you keep adding the manure, but if you stop, then it will start to decline.
And for the
question about inorganic fertilizer,
I have found the figure. The average, the green waste compost was applied once a year at a rate of between 5 and 10 tonnes per hectare.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And the,
the question about the effect of applying inorganic fertilizer on soil carbon?
Mm-hmm.
Louis, I think you'd be best to answer that.
Yeah, okay. Urea clearly increases plant growth, and so you might imagine that that would then increase the carbon content of the soil because you've got more above-ground biomass and below-ground biomass. You may also, though, accelerate the respiration rate. I think there has been work overseas, mainly in cropping systems, that have suggested that the addition of nitrogen could decrease nitrogen carbon content and nitrogen content. However, I would say that this is one of the most hotly contested ideas in the international literature at the moment, with very important and well-respected groups on either side of the argument. Now, this is around cropping soils, and this becomes complicated because cropping systems have large offtakes of carbon as well. And so if you grow more, maybe you take more off. With regard to something like pastoral systems, I would say that we do not know, and it is in fact one of the questions that we are intending to look at in some detail within the centre, where we would be interested in taking a system that has grown grass but has not had urea in the past, and then we would look to add urea to half of an area and compare it to another area that does not get urea, to look at that balance that I talked about before. Do we stimulate photosynthesis more than respiration and therefore gain carbon, or do we stimulate respiration more than photosynthesis and end up with a loss of carbon? So I think the data is just not out there to know whether urea will then increase or decrease soil carbon.
I was wondering whether that decrease in the dairy soil carbons might be attributed to the increased use of urea.
There will be a large number of differences, as you'd know, between dairy and dry stock on flat land. Certainly fertiliser inputs would be one of those. Stocking rate would be another. Management practice would be another one as well. So I would be very cautious to say that it was urea. In fact, I wouldn't say that. We just know that there are differences between the management practices, and the work that we propose in the centre and in other parts of our work funded through the foundation is trying to get at that, what the reasons are.
I'd just like to add to the discussion, considering some of the presentations, but in principle, there are a number of flows of carbon that happens simultaneously, and in the case of the application of fertilizer, it is indeed to grow more herbage, but there aren't many farmers that are going to grow more herbage and not change the utilization of that herbage. And with those two being sort of countered to their opposite processes, if you will, it can be very challenging to interpret the outcome when you have a number of simultaneous processes changing. If you were in principle to add urea fertilizer, you grew more herbage, and you did not change the utilization of that herbage, and by that I mean the grazing, then indeed you'd have a higher leaf litter. You would also potentially change the shoot-to-root ratio. If in contrast, and more commonly, you were to grow more herbage because you want higher utilization, then you're going to add stock to eat that and or push the stock harder. In any case, take off more. You'll end up with quite a different plant community, potentially, than you did before, so that the urea fertilizer has an impact that then gets multiplied through. And unraveling and understanding those various processes that all play a part in determining the soil carbon storage is quite challenging, and it's the subject not only of measurements but also of the process-based models that are being developed, because these processes also take place over long periods of time, as we've been alluding to, and measurement is quite challenging when we're looking at the sorts of long periods that Lewis alluded to in terms of 1980 to 2004. And so we're using models to try to, as indicated in the last slide, understand the drivers of change and to do simulations to try to understand some of the outcomes we've seen. And so the question is a fair one, but there's been a number of changes that go with the use of urea fertilizer, stocking, and other changes. So unraveling the effect of one is challenging.
Thank you.
All right, I'll take another question from the floor.
Kent Atkinson here. There's a Dr. Christine Jones in New Zealand at the moment. She's the founder of the Australian Soil Carbon Accreditation Scheme, known as ASCAS. She's been running field trials in Western Australia for the last 3 years, helpfully underwritten by a philanthropist who pays farmers $25 a tonne for the carbon that they store in soils. She suggested that declining soil carbon levels are due in part to the increased use of high-analysis synthetic fertilisers, which, she says, impede carbon flow to soils and prevent humification. I'm wondering to what extent panel members see the use, in some cases the high level use of synthetic fertilisers in New Zealand, having effectively a double impact by supplanting the addition of organic matter, which historically used to be done, and also impeding the carbon flows to soils and the process of humification.
Yeah, it's Louis here. I think one thing that I would really like to see is some information from people who suggest that these, I've forgotten how you phrased it, fertilizers,
increase the high analysis.
Right, high analysis. That's right. I'd like to see data demonstrating that. And I think this is important. Many of the things that you can talk about in soils, because there are so many multiple inputs and outputs, you can argue about anything you want. You can create a discussion or a logical argument to say, to show that a particular management practice may increase or decrease soil carbon. And it all sounds very logical. But at the end of the day, you can argue it either way. And what you need is hard data, right, to demonstrate these sorts of impacts. My, as far as I'm aware, I am not aware of hard data to demonstrate that for pastoral systems in New Zealand, that the direct effects of fertilizer would increase or decrease soil carbon, because the measurements are simply not there. So I would welcome to see that kind of data. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Presumably the work's been done overseas, though.
One of the things on that is not completely. The difficulty is that most people in the past have tended to look at the top 10 centimetres of soil, because that's where you fertilise, that's where the nutrient contents you need has to be right so you can get maximum response. But the carbon content can vary down to a metre. So our ability to make these measurements down to a metre, or not the ability, we have the ability, but it just hasn't been done that much. this is a relatively new topic, and so these measurements are just not really out there. There is a lot more work that's been done in cropping systems.
Do we have a final question?
Well, I don't want to dominate it, but if I may have another. What about the effect of irrigation? Does that tend to increase soil carbon?
The work that I have seen in terms of overall literature reviews on that, by and large...
Who's speaking now, please?
Sorry, this is Louis.
Yep.
Irrigation has been suggested to increase soil carbon when you look at across all the different systems. But as Frank said before, and I think Brent as well, the response of different soils will differ. So I think you could probably find studies where irrigation has increased and studies where soil carbon has been decreased. A challenge then is to figure out what soils will respond in a positive way and which soils might respond in a negative way.
I would just add to that the changes, once again, that are potentially significant are relatively small. The sampling that's required to detect the small changes that are significant means that, having just recently done a literature review on this subject, a lot of the measurements vary in the depths of sampling, the situation, and there's also an additional effect on the type of agricultural system that we're talking about, whether it's irrigation onto crop, irrigation, for example, onto pasture, grazed by animals, fed by fresh pasture. There's not much of a literature on that, and I would just I should have said at the outset, this is Frank Kelleher. There is also a frustrating if you're hoping for an overseas fix, the information that's available overseas often in principle is very helpful and valuable, but the agricultural practices in New Zealand tend to be different because the climate's different and the animals are fed by year-round grazing outdoors, and consequently the systems are different, and it's not always appropriate to bring across a different system and think that it's going to work here. Once again, we come down to the principle that in order to test or verify, measurements are quite valuable. The sort of changes that we tend to see from irrigation, they take time to manifest and be measurable, and consequently, there's not always a land available that has been similarly managed for decades in order to determine the impact of that one effect. Once again, the conversion farms in Canterbury and Otago, many of those farms have been in dairying less than 10 years. They're subjected to a management regime now that's very different. And while one may see an impact of that changed management, particularly the irrigation on greater plant growth, obviously, once again, those plants are being grown to be eaten. That's why it's being irrigated, and so these changes are, I think, needed to be verified and under the conditions that we have here.
Seems to be a theme emerging here that there's an awful lot we don't know. What work is going on to get these answers in New Zealand?
Well, this is why there is considerable, to David White, it is, I mean, there is fragmented work in many of our organisations. The attempt, though, to bring it together and to start afresh in terms of what are the priority areas for research is now being decided through the New Zealand Agricultural Gas Research Centre. And we do have a strong theme on soil carbon. We have a research programme which has just recently been put together, and we're now about to start that research this winter onwards. So we will be identifying what are the priority areas and focusing on those. simply because, yes, you're right in what you say, that there are bits of data all over the place, but a lot of this work is hampered because there are not the long-term studies that can give us justifiable data.
All right, thank you very much.
Also, just to add to that, Louis here, a lot of the work previously that was being done on soil organic and soil carbon was based, you know, mainly around the soil quality side of things, and we're having to refocus our thinking on that to also include the increases and decreases at depth. So there's a bit of a refocusing going on as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll have to end it there. Thank you very much to our panelists for joining us, and thank you to all the journalists who have dialed in, especially for your good questions. If you would like to access the slides that the presenter showed, those are now available in our resource library, along with the background information that Louis mentioned, and also the video of the soil tomography. There's the large PowerPoint file that's available for download from Brent. And the audio recording will make this available as soon as possible after we wind up here. If you'd like to get in contact with any of our panelists to follow up, just contact the Science Media Center and we will put you in touch. Thank you very much, and this now concludes our briefing.